The Guardian.
Just before we get started with this week's show, I'd like to point you in the direction of Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful, responsive website that looks great on all devices. For your free 14-day trial, head to squarespace.com. Hello, it's Natalie Nahai here, and on today's show, The Dark Net. So for the average person, the internet is a place where you go to check your emails, write on your mate's Facebook walls, and of course spend copious amounts of time looking at pictures of cats, or armadillos if you're me. But for a small percentage of internet goers, there's an underside to the World Wide Web. This alter internet is hidden in plain sight to the general public, just a click away, but only reachable to those who actually know how to access it. So what's the purpose of this secondary, quote-unquote, darker internet? Well, to find out, today I'll be speaking to Jamie Bartlett, an author who has written extensively about the subject, and we'll also be joined by the writer and director of Darknet, a play that's just opened in London, about the dark web's uses and applications and how it affects us all. Stick around, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. The darknet is a complex subject, even for the most seasoned tech user. Despite the fact that it's right under our noses, the vast majority of us who use the internet on a regular basis have no knowledge of its existence or what to do with it if we do stumble across it. Luckily for us, Jamie Bartlett is in the studio with us today. He's director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos and the author of The Darknet Inside the Digital Underworld, which is an amazing book. I highly recommend you check it out. So if anyone is the expert on the darknet, it's going to be him. So Jamie, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
So for our less tech savvy listeners, what exactly is the darknet?
So it is an encrypted part of the internet made up of, no one knows for sure, but anywhere between 10 and 50,000 websites that you access with a special web browser called the Tor browser. That browser allows you to really go on any parts of the internet without giving away your location. So you kind of stay hidden. And with that browser, you can access this dark net. And that dark net is very, very difficult indeed to censor the sites that are on there. And so as a result, you have kind of anonymous web browsers visiting sites that are impossible to censor. And so you can kind of imagine what happens. It becomes this amazingly interesting and quite terrifying Wild West where anyone who has reason to stay hidden or secretive finds quite a natural home there. So you have very good uses for that. You have whistleblower sites, privacy activists, human rights activists who rely on that to stay hidden, often from state security apparatus. And then you have the misuses of the same technology, the people that use it for illegal pornography, illegal marketplaces, hacking services, and much more else besides.
And who was it that actually set up the darknet?
You know, we don't actually know who set up the darknet, but we do know who set up the browser, the Tor browser. And that was a research project by the US Navy Intelligence Department, because they needed a way of trying to browse the web without giving away their location too. And this was an incredible idea. It's a really clever piece of software. But they realized actually that if they were the only ones using this neat little system, it wouldn't be much good because everyone would guess it was them anyway. So they open sourced it, made it available to everybody, and it got picked up by privacy activists and civil rights activists who turned it into an open source project. And it won loads of awards, actually, for spreading democracy and freedom in the world. And that's where the browser starts. You know, anyone can use it. It's really easy. It's really simple.
So giving with one hand and taking with the other, because you obviously then got things like the NSA that are trying to clamp down and privatize the web, which includes making anonymized browsing much more difficult.
Yes, I mean, and that kind of reflects the different priorities of different parts of government. And there was for a while this quite ridiculous situation where the State Department was funding the development of the Tor browser while the FBI were trying to crack the Tor browser and introduce weaknesses in it. Because both of them had different reasons. For the State Department, this is an amazing way of spreading democracy in the world. And for the FBI, it's a massive headache because it makes it harder for them to investigate crime at home. So that quite neatly sums up the problem, actually, with browsers and any type of device or software that allows you to stay hidden online, that it can be used for lots of different reasons, good and bad.
And that really sort of underpins the struggle between those two points of view, so privatization versus anonymity.
Yeah, and it's kind of at the it's almost the perfect version of that struggle that we're all going through all the time, because it's the, in a way, it's one of the most powerful pieces of software to stay hidden online. It's being used by millions of people. It's being used for some of the worst things imaginable in society and some of the most important, valuable things in society. So it's like the debate we always have now about privacy online and what data we're sharing and who's watching us. When it comes to the darknet, that is the same debate, but sort of multiplied several times over.
So how easy is it to gain access then? If you're using Tor, which is, stands for the Onion Router, how easy is it to use that to get access to these hidden sites?
It's incredibly easy. Well, that's the great myth about it. If you call it the dark net, it sounds like you somehow have to go through layers and layers and layers, deeper and deeper and deeper down the labyrinth before you get there. The worrying thing about it, in a way, is that once you've downloaded the browser, which you do with a click, it's like any other web browser. And you go onto the darknet like you'd go onto any other website.
So talk us through your first experience exploring the darknet then.
Oh, I'd rather not.
Well, or one of your favoured.
Well, you know, the thing about the going onto these hidden services, technically they're called Tor hidden services, not the darknet. And insofar as they are called the darknet, it refers to obscurity rather than nastiness. But the interesting thing and the slightly strange thing about being on the darknet is, yes, you can often be a couple of clicks away from illegal pornography and hidden marketplaces where you can buy anything at all. And that creates a slightly strange dynamic, because there's always a risk that people can become quite used to that and forget maybe how serious it is, because it feels very simple to access and it doesn't feel like something so bad could be so easy to find, for example. So the sort of challenge is that once you're on this part of the net, because it feels like the internet and you're using your normal laptop and you're using a browser and you're with your mouse and you're with, well, no one uses mice, I still use a mouse. It doesn't feel like it's serious. It feels very quickly, it feels completely ordinary. It feels like the normal internet and it looks like the ordinary internet. It's a little bit slower. It's not driven by marketing and advertising interests, so it's a little less slick in terms of website design. But other than that, it's very, very familiar to everybody. So you have these darknet markets, of which there are many, and which operate just like Amazon or eBay, user reviews, amazing customer service, incredible array of different products on offer, except they're drugs. It's quite confusing because you're presented with something that on the one hand is very familiar, but on the other is very different.
One of the things I really liked about your book was how it challenged people's assumptions about the safety of using certain services or the ordinariness or the dynamics beneath certain marketplaces. So, for instance, if you go onto Amazon, you'll see user reviews, you'll see ratings, people will leave comments, and how things like Silk Road and other various marketplaces on the darknet will rely even more heavily on those sorts of dynamics to allow people to make purchases that they're going to kind of favour over other competitors. Does that make sense?
That user review system and how you create a system of trust when nobody knows who anybody else is. There's no trading standards you can go to, or you can't complain to the police that you haven't received the correct product because you're going to get arrested. So you have to try to create a system which allows users to make informed decisions about the products that they buy. And so to create a competitive marketplace where everyone's anonymous and you're dealing with criminals is in fact incredibly difficult. And because you don't have all of that sort of all the support of sort of legal authorities to regulate the market, people have to regulate it themselves. And they do that by becoming incredibly efficient in terms of the importance of the user reviews and the reputation systems and the forums where people discuss different products and discuss different vendors. And so it becomes almost like a hypermarket. Oh, it sounds French, doesn't it? It becomes like a hyper-competitive, hyper-functioning, pure market, which in many cases is what black markets are. They're a purer form of a market system. And that creates an incredible amount of competition, which creates, for the people that buy these drugs, often frankly, better products. But it also, of course, there's many problems with that as well, because it basically means that more people can go and buy anything that they want. And that is obviously a problem for society. Mm.
So in the researching for your book, it's obviously going to be quite difficult to interview darknet users who have a big incentive to maintain their privacy. How did you find the research process there?
Generally speaking, and not everyone that I interviewed was in Tor hidden services or on the darknet, but a lot of them were very worried about their identity and their online identity being matched to their offline identity, this idea of doxing people, of connecting digital and real lives. But, you know, the interesting thing is that a lot of people that live in strange internet subcultures feel quite misunderstood. And so if you can convince them to trust you, to speak to you, that you won't give up their identities, they won't stop talking. They're so desperate to have their voices out there, to talk about the worlds that they inhabit, that they think other people don't really understand, that they'll be incredibly open. And with some people, I interviewed a number of people who remained anonymous. So you've got lots of different secure chat rooms and different messaging apps that actually now, when I started the book, there weren't so many, but now there's so many of these secure encrypted messaging apps that you can also interview people when you're both anonymous, and then people are often incredibly open and honest. The problem then is, how do you verify their stories? And that's a kind of different order of problem, and that was very, very difficult to do, but it wasn't the problem I expected. I'd thought no one would speak to me. Actually, everyone spoke to me. The problem was, how do I verify some of their stories?
When you're talking about anonymity and people being quite open with sharing their opinions and their ideas and their experiences, did you come across many Snowden-style libertarians earnestly fighting for cyber freedom, or was it much more in the realm of people just wanting to be able to work in free markets, get free drugs, or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's very strange. Particularly on the darknet markets, there's a weird mix of people who are really quite radical crypto anarchists or libertarians who believe in the existence of a perfect, unfettered marketplace that governments cannot regulate or properly monitor. It's really a political project. It's trying to undermine the ability of the state to control us, to control our lives, to tax us. And for the really hardcore crypto anarchists and libertarians, this is a way of not just the dark net, but cryptocurrencies and any type of software that keeps you hidden from view basically weakens the government. Because if they can't tax us and they can't monitor us, they can't control us, and they start losing their legitimacy. And so for some of these people, these darknet markets were a political project and still are a political project. And then, of course, you had people turning up who just wanted to sell or buy drugs. And you had this kind of strange mix of visionaries and political radicals and drug dealers and drug users all sort of working together, all with their own reasons for trying to keep this marketplace working.
So having done all the research around the book and seeing the research that's come out since the book, on balance, would you say that the darknet, I know I'm going to ask, is more a force for good than it is a force for bad? Can we be that reductionist?
We can say it's a force for both. It's definitely a force for both. And I think it's being used more for both purposes. And actually, how you'd weigh that up might depend on your view of the world. If you're really worried about the use of drugs among young people, you might say it's a force for bad. And if you're not so worried about that, and you're more worried about individual freedom, particularly in dangerous parts of the world, in non-democratic parts of the world, you'll probably say it's a force for good. So it really is going to depend on what you think is important.
That was a very beautifully summed up description there. So thanks, Jamie. When we come back, my producer Matt and I attend the press night performance of Darknet, the play, to find out just how production about a loaded topic like this is pieced together.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. Whether the story behind your passion is out of the ordinary or simply out of this world, you should tell it in an unforgettable way. Squarespace helps you do just that, with the only websites designed to showcase what makes your passion worth pursuing. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
Squarespace. A couple of days ago, I ventured to Southwark in London to see a new play about the dark net, and this is what happened. So I'm outside the Southwark Playhouse in a rather noisy London with my producer Matt, and we're here to see the play called Darknet. It's press night, and we've got the opportunity to talk to some of the people involved in the production of the play to hear about what inspired their artistic approach to this rather technological topic.
No more giving away for free. No more watching others profit from what is yours. When you share data with Octopus, our algorithms calculate the real-time market value and transfer it straight to your OctoPay wallet.
And I am very excited to be chatting with the producer, Kendall Massan. So what are some of the different characters or storylines that we see in the play?
Sure, it's quite a complex storyline. So there are 7 actors and there's about 40 characters. So the audience will see lots of quick changes, and it was a real challenge for the actors. So there is one storyline which has to do with a young teenager who's trying to help out her mother who has a drug problem by buying her methadone in the deep web. Then there's another storyline about the corporate side. So it's someone who runs this company called Octopus, who is trying to sort of see the marketing press angle and really trying to help this company be successful by taking people's data. And then there's also a hacker who is... Well, the audience will have to come see the show to find out for themselves.
From your perspective, why do you feel that this story is so important right now?
It's so relevant right now. I mean, it's crazy. You know, I take the tube coming to Southwark Playhouse and everybody's on their phone. And, you know, the data that is just sort of out there and how much information is known about you, it's really relevant and it's scary. I mean, you're watching the show and you're realizing, you know, these characters, it's actually you. And, you know, the questions they're asking themselves are the questions that you as an audience member are also asking yourself.
So one of the guests that we're having on the show today is Jamie Bartlett, who's written a fantastic book about the darknet, and it's quite a journalistic exploration of a lot of the themes and structures that exist around that. Would you say that yours is a more creative investigation of some of these things?
Yeah, I think that would be a good way of saying it. How sort of what Rose and Russell have done is really, yeah, creatively investigating it. How can we bring sort of the internet and this idea of the deep web to the stage? You know, theater is the most sort of live and present art form, and so how can we make something that is not tangible very tangible sort of for audiences? So yeah, to creatively look at what does it look like, what is the world, what is the sound and the feel and the visual life of this sort of unknown world.
So tell me, what's your name and what's your role or roles in the production?
My name is Robin Berry, and in this show I play, I sort of play the father of one of the main characters, but including voiced characters from offstage, I think I'm probably playing about 12 or 13 different parts in the show.
And what's the overall premise of the play?
So basically it's set a little bit further in the future from where we are now, but the idea is that at the moment, let's say Facebook, you share, you like stuff, Facebook takes all that information, they sell it to other companies, and then they fill your pages up with adverts for stuff that you're like, weird, I looked at that the other day. And in our world, what has happened is that a company called Octopus Inc. has taken that mantle, but what they do is they share the profits with you. So it's the kind of first step to encouraging very cynical people to try and get more involved in it. And the company then uses it. They add all this up, they look at cultural trends, they look at everything all across the world, they tie it up and they know what you're gonna want before you want it. They know the best time to have a baby or to get married and yeah, it's pretty scary stuff really.
Am I gonna take over your life?
Yeah.
So the darknet seems to be making quite a political statement also about the world that we're living in today. Mm-hmm. What sort of parallels do you think it's drawing?
There's so much stuff nowadays on social media, how much time children spend putting their personal details up online, all this stuff to do with companies who employ people now, looking at your Facebook profile and learning more about you before you come in. And I mean, obviously, then there's just Big Brother and governmental decisions and there's all the big Panama Papers type kickoff and all this kind of stuff. Everything really ties in, without giving too much away. It's very, very, very current.
Did you actually do any research in preparation for the play?
As soon as I realised, I downloaded a Tor browser onto my phone and I started. I don't always do it because it can be slightly longer. It's slower than using Google, yeah. But I did have a few moments of, now, actually, if there's certain things I want to look at, if I'm going to look at houses or if I'm going to look at kind of mortgage brokers or things, sometimes I use my Tor browser just because I don't want companies to then phone me up, because it's how it works. And I didn't really think about it that way, but you know, I mean, you sort of have to start thinking about protecting yourself, really, which sounds super paranoid and conspiracy theory, but the play has made me, yeah, or
maybe the right tool for the right job,
yeah, or sensible. exactly, yeah.
Robin, thank you very much.
Men of Tech Weekly, we've teamed up with Cornerstone to give you an offer that will save you time and money and give you a closer shave than ever before. With Cornerstone, you'll never have to worry about your blades being blunt again. They'll deliver their super sharp, award-winning razors right to your door. Because you listen to Tech Weekly, Cornerstone are giving you £10 off your first order. And if you're not 100% satisfied, Cornerstone will give you your money back with absolutely no questions asked. Head on over to cornerstone.co.uk/tech and discover an even better way to shave, starting from as little as £4. That's cornerstone.co.uk/tech.
So we're lucky enough to have Darknet playwright Rose Lewenstein and director Russell Bender here with us today. Rose and Russell, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So Rose, how did you stumble into the world of the Darknet? Did you visit it and were you surprised by what you found?
Well, I stumbled into it intentionally first when we decided to start researching this play and started talking about that about 3 years ago. My first experience on Tor, I guess it was a bit of an anti-climax, because like Jamie was saying earlier, you expect it to be this kind of dangerous wild west of the internet, and then you're like, oh, I don't know what to look for, because there's nothing is indexed. So you find Silk Road, and once you get over the novelty of drugs and guns advertised on an eBay-like marketplace, it's kind of, where do I go next? And then the more that you kind of find links between forums and sites, and there was only so much I could do because it's only really one aspect of the play, the more you start to get to know how much you can't access in a way, because I wanted to have a look into hacker forums, and obviously not being a hacker, I'm not going to be allowed in there because it's invite only. So there was only a certain amount I could look at, and I spent quite a long time looking through various forums, getting to know the marketplaces.
So could you tell us about some of these sites? Because it's not just drugs and hackers and guns. There are other things, for instance, like Assassination Market, which is altogether different in terms of like what...
Yeah, and that was another novelty, because it sounds like something that's made up. And I did come across quite a few assassination websites where people were in a very friendly way. I think there was one character, in fact, called Friendly Hitman. I can't remember if he was a real guy or if I made him up in one of the drafts, but who was... advertising his services in a very professional sounding way, and it seems quite normal until you realize he's actually saying, I'm going to kill a human being for you. There's another thing called the Death Pool, which I think is an assassination market that Jamie wrote about as well in the book, which is essentially where users can place bets on when high profile people are going to be assassinated. And so I guess the theory, Jamie will know a lot more than me, is that if there's enough money in the pot, then it will give somebody the incentive to go and kill whoever's name is up there, whether it's a politician or a celebrity or someone's next door neighbour.
So what are some of the issues that the Darknet threw up for you as a writer?
I guess the place I started was the marketplaces. And what's interesting about that is that it immediately gives the user the power to make their own decisions about what's wrong and what's right. And you'll go on and say, okay, this is okay that this guy is selling marijuana. This is not really okay that this guy is selling a gun, but maybe it's kind of more okay than this person who's selling a hitman service or certain types of extreme pornography. And then you step back and realize that we can't really draw the line there between what's right and wrong, because the whole point of this libertarian environment is that it's completely governed by supply and demand of the marketplace. But also it's probably important for me to say that although the play is named Darknet, that is one argument or one side to the play and one thread of the play. And contrasting that is the opposing world of transparency and privatization and data And so there are these two things battling against each other. So whilst there are arguments in the play within the darknet itself, I think it's more to do with this spectrum of transparency versus privacy.
Russell, can you tell us, what do you think that the darknet in all its plurality represents in today's society? Is it an ode to privacy or a stance against the corporate machine? Is it about libertarianism?
I think it's all those things. I think in the play, we mostly see it as, I think of the play as having two strong opposing arguments, and that I'm sure that the audience will all respond very differently. For me, I think that neither of those arguments is wholly right. But in the play, one of those arguments is about we must be sharing our data, we must be monetizing our data. It's a really powerful tool to make society better, and we need to use that. And of course, there's truth, a lot of truth in that. And the opposing argument of, in giving away our data, we're giving away our privacy, and taking that to an extreme and sort of libertarian, I think Jamie used the word earlier, crypto-anarchist viewpoint. So in the play, the darknet, as we represent it, is more about privacy, more about escaping from the corporate world, escaping from online advertisers tracking you, escaping from people tracking every piece of your data. I think we just touch a little bit in the play, and it's certainly something that I think is very important for technology as a whole, of all of the positive uses of it and all of the human rights uses of it and all of those sides of things. Mm.
So Jamie, can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with the creation of Darknet, the play?
Well, I think Rose and Russell have to remind me as well about exactly when we met, but it was probably about 2 years ago.
Last summer.
I think it was when we were first starting to think about actually what the play was about.
Round.
Because about 3 years ago, Russell took me for a drink and said, I'm interested in making a show that looks at hacking and perhaps cyber warfare and the way we engage with stuff online. And obviously that's like saying, Rose, I'm thinking of writing a play about Europe. And so it took quite a while for us to, what we did at first was cast the net extremely wide and go, right, where are all the areas that we want to look? And when we were in that process, Jamie was one of the people who was very influential in like pointing us in the right directions and brought up some really, really interesting things that really stuck with me the whole way through, even when I then decided what the play was and it was quite far removed from the stuff we were workshopping.
Yeah. I mean, we were sort of discussing actually a lot of the things we've been discussing today. Like, is the darknet about privacy, and or is it also about, in some ways, is it a political statement? Is it a personal statement? How does that play against transparency? What are the people like? What are the characters like who reside in these like digital corners? We were just sort of knocking ideas around about all of this. And I, to be honest with you, I had no idea how they were going to try and represent it on a stage, because it's incredibly difficult. And I've been asked before to do some kind of visual work of showing life online, and it's really difficult.
It is difficult, but it would be absolutely mad not to, as theatre makers, start to engage with some of these things. And there are lots of writers and directors and companies doing some really interesting, exciting work around this area. And I feel like we don't quite understand it yet, and we don't know how to fuse this technology and this art form that are just so like chalk and cheese.
And what are the kind of audiences that you find you're attracting? Because obviously there you're going to have your avid theatre goers. In fact, one of the guys I was sitting next to last night was an avid theatre goer as opposed to a tech critic. But then you're also going to get people who are really interested in the darknet, in technology, from a more geeky perspective, which is kind of where I was coming in from that perspective. But what are you finding in terms of the people who come to watch?
I think it's still early in the run to say exactly who we're managing to reach. We've certainly had really positive, enthusiastic feedback from theatre people who are not at all familiar with some of the ideas and have never been on the deep web or the dark net. We've had tech people in who have a lot of relationship with data, who work in data in some form, who've been very excited by a play that tries to tackle those ideas, and from tech companies who are also keen to see those ideas talked about and represented on stage. I think we really hope that there's so many different ideas in the play, but that some of those ideas will be exciting to people, whether or not they've got a prior relationship with, whether it's privatization of data or whether it's privacy, and for people, whether they have a hugely active online life or whether this is all stuff that's very new to them.
You could be a tech person and still like the theatre. What are you talking about? But you know, can I? Because I think it's really important, actually, for art and sort of artistic endeavour to talk about and to engage with data and life online in the way that Rose says, because that's what we're all doing, and it has huge implications for politics and society. It's so deeply interwoven now into all the different things we do, and yet somehow for a lot of people feels outside that, something different, but it's not. And so art has to get involved.
As was once said, the personal is the political. So that's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much to my guests, to Jamie Bartlett, Rose Lowenstein and Russell Bender. Darknet is on at the Southwark Playhouse in London through to the 7th of May. And the book, The Darknet, is now available and has been for a while in good bookshops. If you haven't got it already, go and check it out. I'm Natalie Nahai on Twitter, at Natalie Nahai. This week's episode of Tech Weekly was produced by the lovely Simon Barnard and Matt Shaw. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.